If you're listening to this, then you likely already know that being an independent musician can be a lonely road. And maybe your friends and your family just don't fully understand why you do what you do or why you invest so much time, energy, and money towards achieving your music goals. And especially early on, it can be hard to find people who really understand what you're trying to accomplish and how to make it happen. So that's where Modern Musician comes in. My name is Michael Walker, and you know, I can understand and relate to that feeling. I've been there myself, and so has our team of independent artists. And the truth is that basically everything good in my life has been the result of music. It's the reason I met my wife. It's why I have my three kids. It's how I met my best friends. And now with Modern Musician, we've seen so many talented artists who started out with a dream, with a passion, but without really a fan base, without a business, and be able to take that and turn it into a sustainable full-time career and be able to impact hundreds of thousands, even millions of fans with their music. And we've had thousands of messages from artists who've told us that we've helped change their lives forever. And it just gets even more exciting, fulfilling when you're surrounded by a community of other people who get it and who share their success and their knowledge with each other openly. And so if you are feeling called to make your music a full-time career and to be able to reach more people with your music, then I want to invite you to join our community so that we can support your growth and help lift you up as you pursue your musical dreams. You'll be able to interact in a community with other high-level artists, coaches, and industry professionals, as well as be able to participate in our daily live podcasts, meet these amazing guests, and get access to completely free training. If you'd like to join our family of artists who truly care about your success, then click on the link in the show notes and sign up now.
It ultimately, to me, just keeps boiling down to like emotion and connection. You know, a fan should be emotionally resonating. You know, the music should resonate with them. It doesn't matter, you know, it could be deep and meaningful music. It could just be music to kind of get wasted and have a party to. It's not the point. It's whatever sort of connects with you.
Welcome to the Modern Musician Podcast, where each week I help you turn your passion for making music into a profitable career. This is all about you discovering and expressing who you really are so that you can build a loyal fan base that truly resonates with you and with your music, and you can impact more people with your artwork. I'm your host, Michael Walker, and let's get into it. All right, I'm excited to be here today with my new friend, Darren Hemmings. So Darren, let me get a quick intro. Darren founded Motive Unknown in 2011, scaled it to a 30-strong team serving 60-plus top-tier music clients. He has worked with elite independent labels, global pop acts, and leading music production brands. He's also the author of Network Notes, which is a go-to industry newsletter that shapes music business insights. And so I'm really excited to have him on the podcast today to talk a little bit about where we're at right now, and in the time of recording this, there's some big revolutions and movements happening in tech, and how those things intersect with arts and culture. It could be really interesting. Sort of like two different like chords starting to like come together, and my keyboard's probably going to sound really bad. Oh, gosh, like the velocity is like real bad right now. I need to fix it, but I'm imagining like dissonant notes. Yeah, this sounds great. Dissonant notes, like when they come together, there's like there's kind of conflicting, clashing dissonant notes. But if you like, oh man, it's real bad. I need to fix the velocity on that. Anyways, Darren, it's great to have you on the podcast. Thank you for taking the time, and looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to get into it. It's going to be a good chat.
Absolutely. So, you know, maybe for anyone that this is their first time connecting with you, can you share just a little bit about who you are and how you found yourself founding this company and working with the types of artists that are in the roster?
Ooh, that's a lot of years to stuff into a short space of time. So I've been in the music business since the late 90s. I actually started doing IT support for Sony Music back in the day when they were still in their like golden era, right? Of like System of a Down and, you know, Cypress Hill awesome. And J-Lo and the South Park album. And, you know, they were kings of the hill for a while there. But I was actually at Sony through like 1999, 2000 as well, when like it kind of went from the highest of highs to sort of off a cliff in the face of Napster and stuff. So, you know, it was around then. And then I took a bit of time out running a label, doing radio, doing other things. And then joined a company called Pias in about 2009 as the head of digital marketing there, and led a bunch of campaigns for three years there. And then I left in 2011 to found Motive Unknown. And, you know, it's just a one-man outfit, basically. Mainly motivated. Well, it was
like a stupid pun on like motive unknown. I was just like unknown.
Yeah. I mean, people still go, what is the motive? And you're like, oh, really? It's been 14 years. Come on. But no, you know, so I started that. And the first band I worked with on that was a group called Alt J. And they went platinum here in the UK and won the Mercury Prize. And I suppose that kind of gilded things for the agency.
Lovely.
Yeah. So did all that, grew. And, you know, we've been across scores of things ever since. But now, as you said in your excellent intro, there's now about 30 of us. We have about 65 clients as an agency, about 35 indie labels, probably 10 or 15 artist clients. And then we also work with brands in the sort of music production space. So we have clients like UJam and, Sound Labs. Sound Labs that do the AI voice cloning and stuff like that. So we're kind of at both ends in this sort of, you know, we work with the people selling to people making music, and then at the other end, we're working with the people that have been signed and are trying to release the music and get somewhere with it. It keeps growing. It's doing very well. And I think really we're just there to help these people connect with audiences in a meaningful way that gives them a kind of lasting relationship with their fans. I think, you know, I've always approached this with a steadfast view that I think marketing is made vulgar by bad marketers. You know, it's like advertising is vulgar because you're so used to being smashed over the head with it in every conceivable way. But it doesn't mean that it's sort of inherently bad. It usually means that the people doing it are bad. And it's the same with marketing. I think if you get it right, you know, the fans love it. You know, if it's being done well, the fans are grateful for it because they're being made aware of things that they love, and also they're not being made aware of things that they don't love. You know, there's an art to this. So I'm kind of proud that what we've built is something that really helps those labels and artists kind of connect with those fans and build, you know, longer term relationships that, you know, work in every direction. Because let's be honest, you know, I think when you're an artist, you're trying to sell. You know, that's the awkward truth. You're trying to sell people on your music. You're trying to get their attention. And it can be quite difficult because you sort of have to force yourself on people a little bit. You know, they're not just going to find you of their own volition. So you've got to put yourself in front of them. And I think in doing that, you know, it's an art to doing this in a manner that, authentic and meaningful. I mean, I think all these words have been a bit overused, right? Everyone tosses them around now like they, you know, they don't mean anything almost, but I think it is, it ultimately to me just keeps boiling down to like emotion and connection. You know, a fan should be emotionally resonating. You know, the music should resonate with them. It doesn't matter, you know, it could be deeper, meaningful music. It could just be music to kind of get wasted and have a party to. It's not the point. It's whatever sort of connects with you. And it's then taking that emotion to connect with the artist more and nurture that relationship. I think, in and of itself, it's not complicated. I think we've all just made it very complicated and we've allowed a lot of things to get in the way to complicate things further. Mm. How's that for a run through? Oh,
that was great. Man, that was like profound. I like it. So what I'm hearing you say is that I'm really at its core. What you've learned and what you've built is really about helping artists to connect with their fans and build a community. And yeah, there's a lot of fancy and advanced like tactics, things to try to like do that, but it's probably a lot simpler than we make it out to be. Often it's just about like people coming together and providing value. I really like what you said about marketing and sales too as a function. It does seem like there's sort of a those words are tainted a little bit. Tainted is it's kind of a strong word, but like there's sort of this feeling of like, I don't know, like, especially with artists, like we don't want to quote unquote sell out, or it's somehow like wrong or manipulative to like market. We're trying to convince someone to like do something that they don't want to do. But what you're saying is, you know, actually when it's done right, this is about you actually just providing value and about you figuring out who are the people that genuinely would resonate and get value from what you offer. And just by like letting them know that you have this thing that's going to benefit them.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I think when, I mean, one of the ones I always loved was I took my family to see Metallica when they were playing in London one year. And Metallica just had it down so cleverly. Like, I mean, they're Metallica, right? They, you know, you can't. It's a bit like when people used to reference Radiohead sort of giving away one of their albums. It was like, yeah, but they're Radiohead. You know, they're not you. So it's not a like for like. But Metallica, I think, have really sort of, I mean, at points, I think they get it wrong and they go a bit far. But I just remember going to this concert and they had their own beer for sale, but they were selling them in cups that were these plastic cups that said "and beer for all" in the kind of "and justice for all" font. Mm. Of course, everyone's then just, it's like the cheapest merch ever, because I think you could get the cup for like £2, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the thing I remember most was, like, my son at the time was about, I don't know, 10, you know, he's very young. And they had roadies going around giving the kids these like Metallica plectrums with the kind of M on the one side and then the date of the concert on the other. So they're like unique, but they weren't giving them to the adults. They were giving them to the kids. Now, I'm sure someone somewhere will look at that and go, that's sneaky or that's nefarious. But my son, like, it made his day. Like, he had something we didn't get, and, you know, it made a lot to him. And I don't know. I just think there's sometimes with these things, it's, you know, I think with a lot of marketing as well. I mean, I work with Run the Jewels, and it's something we talk about a lot with Run the Jewels, is like the give versus the take. And Run the Jewels earned a lot of goodwill by giving their albums away and going, all right, we're just, if you want the record, have the record. Here it is on a download. Just give us your email. You can have the whole thing. And they've done that with every album they've released. And it earns so much goodwill that people view them very much as like, they're happy to spend money on tickets and vinyl and stuff like that, because it started with a give, and then they earn the right to, you know, take in the sense of saying, all right, well, we've got the record for sale on vinyl, you know. And I mean, you know, when we did that on the last record, we raised over $1 million in less than 24 hours, all of which went to BLM charities, because it came out in the wake of the George Floyd murder and all that kind of thing. So, but it was a sign of just the people power involved and the goodwill and the love that people have when, you know, when you give a bit first. And I think that counts for a lot.
Mm. Wow, that's super powerful. Yeah, so, you know, focusing on providing value first and giving as, you know, both, like, even if you are like wanting to be selfish and get more, like, it is kind of like ironic that like the best way to do that is actually by giving more and providing more value, building reciprocity. Yeah. And ultimately, that doesn't make you have less. But when you give, you actually have more. Isn't that like an interesting paradox?
Well, it is. But I think in this world, the more I run a company, the more I realize that much of success lies in normally slightly bucking against what feels like the logical path. You know, it's the easy path, right? It's like with this, you know, you can just stand there banging on going, my record is out now, everyone should listen. And everyone, you know, but the reality is everyone else is going, all right, man, but you're one of like 3,000 artists who've bothered me in this way in the last 2 weeks. Like, why should I care about you? So taking that time to build connection, I think, is totally worth it. And finding ways to do that. I mean, someone on my team, he's just moved on to a different role now, but he, you know, he was releasing music and he was putting stuff out on cassette and just doing it in limited runs because it made it more collectible. And in his scene, that created more connection. And so, you know, you could argue that it's an arcane format and there's all these things, but his audience loved that and he made that available and it worked for them. So, you know, there's all these ways that you can build these connections. It doesn't have to be, I don't think it has to be grotesque. You know, it can just be, as long as it's honest and real and in line with your vision, you know, I think then that's where it works, because it's something I see quite a lot where people want artists to just all do the same thing. It's like, oh, you should be posting on TikTok. You should be on Instagram. You should be blah, blah, blah. But, you know, every artist is different. And, you know, I was talking to a label the other day and they were saying, okay, almost every artist on our label now just refuses to use social media because they're done. Mm. They're just over it. And they're like, they won't do it. So we've now got to find different ways of, you know, it doesn't mean that they're not on social media, because obviously, you know, there's many an artist I could probably think of that don't, you know, post regularly on social media. But if you search social media, there's lots of other people posting about them. So they're all over social media, but just not of their own creation, you know, of their own injection of their stuff into it. So, yeah, you know, there's ways and means of still going about doing these kinds of things. But it's listening first to sort of go, well, where do you want to be and what's authentic to you? And then amplify that. Don't feel like you got to just chase the ambulance because everybody else is doing that. That's not the way to do it.
Mm. It's so good. Yeah, the thought that came up as it related to that, like giving versus taking, because I mean, just from like a physics standpoint, like if you have like two people and like one person has something and it gives it to someone else, then like normally you think like you're losing something. You're like, you're giving away something. And like, you know, so it's actually not like a good thing, but as you're saying, like, it's actually, it's the opposite. Like with business is like, actually like it's when you get like, it's maybe more like a tree that's like blossoming and creating fruits. It's almost like you're giving, it's like you're producing fruits and you're like, and the fruits are dropping. But actually when you do that, you're not losing something because those can multiply and they can blossom and then they can like propagate.
I mean, it's perceived value, I think, you know, because like, you know, I've been in this long enough. I remember when Topspin was the hot thing and everyone was giving away a track for email. But of course, when everybody's doing it, it's not special anymore. You know, it's that, who's the baddie? And is this Syndrome or whatever his name is in The Incredibles, who sort of has that line that, you know, once everybody's super, nobody is. And it's that, right? So if you're all just following the same thing and doing the same thing that everybody else does, then yeah, that's not going to fly. So, you know, finding that value. I mean, I think that's where Run the Jewels nailed it with the album. Everyone else has given away tracks. And when they first started, they're like, no, we're just going to give the whole record, which at the time, I mean, for years after that, if anyone mentioned that in a label meeting or going, well, maybe we just give the record away, you could feel the sort of air chill as everyone was, they just look at you like you've taken leave of your senses. But then I was sat there going, okay, but we've got 500,000 people on a mailing list over here from giving things away. So tell me again that it doesn't work, because it does. You know, it's just got to be done right. So
that's so powerful. Yeah, there's another point that you made earlier that I thought was worth reiterating, which is the way you put it is, you know, when Radiohead like gives away a song, you know, it's like a little bit different than an average run of the mill, like giving away the song. And I felt like that just kind of like harkens to, using the word harkens, right? I think that's like one of the first times I've ever used harkens, but it's a great word. I think it harkens to the power of just of going deep on your product and making it so good that that almost market, yeah, like in order to market something, like you want to make sure that the thing you have is like actually like really valuable and it's going to like change people's lives. And you know, you do kind of, you need that like equation in order for letting people know about the thing to like work as well. So I really like what you're talking about as it relates to artists being authentic and you know, focusing on their craft and actually like creating something amazing as well, which is like not necessarily a separate thing from marketing. Like when it's done well, it's like actually like maybe the most important form of marketing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I always remember the band Salt, you know, S-A-U-L-T from over here in the UK, when they put their, I think it was their third or fourth release, but it was called Untitled As Is, I think. It was either that or Untitled Rise. I forget which order they came out in. But, you know, they put those up on Bandcamp in a pretty low-key style. And, I mean, the word of mouth on that when it came out was just like nothing I've seen in years, you know. But it was that thing of like the right music at the right time. And, you know, there were essentially protest albums about black identity shortly after the George Floyd stuff, a bit like RTJ4. And yeah, I mean, it really caught fire because it resonated with people. It created an intense kind of emotional response and connection with it. But to my knowledge, I don't think they spent a penny on paid marketing or doing anything. They just put it up and it went, you know. And the thing is, you know, it's sometimes it's a bit of an awkward truth, right? It's like, you know, you get records that just land in such a manner that, you know, you're away and they have a momentum of their own. And it's almost like for people like me, you're kind of running behind this snowballing thing, just trying to keep up. And it's pretty crazy to try and do that. But yeah, I mean, it speaks to the fact that the art first and foremost is what is the marketing, you know, it creates something so massive that people want to invest in that. And I think it's something people, I don't think people focus on this small fact enough, but I do put a lot of stock in the idea that, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but you know, those early fans are a bit like early stage investors. You know, I think there is still that kudos of being able to say that I turned you on to this band and I was into them before you or anyone else, because it gilds my cool, if you like, to be like, yeah, I heard this group before you did. But you know, I saw that really firsthand with Alt J. You know, I remember them playing the Africa Center here in London in Covent Garden to like maybe 200 people. you know, and within a year they were playing the O2 to, I don't know, 15,000 people. And a big, big part of that was just word of mouth. You know, the 200 people that were at the Africa Center, you feel like every one of them told 10 people, and it spreads like a virus, you know, and it just goes. And I think people these days, when people are marketing, it's almost like they forget these simple social dynamics. And it's like, if you can just convince other people to be your evangelists, then it makes your life a lot easier. So even encourage them to be your evangelists, give them reasons to spread word, you know, help them, reward them, do whatever, but never, ever underestimate that value of, I'm going to go off and tell 10 of my friends. Because if everyone does that, you've just 10x'd your audience and you're away, you know, so yeah. That's how you approach it.
And even then, like, there's like, well, almost like an exponential effect, you know, depending on how many of their friends that they shared also share it with like 10 other friends.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. You know, I mean, at that time, for the band to sell 300,000 albums in the UK, there was only 9 acts that year that did that. So pretty rare, you know, and it just came out of nowhere. So yeah, I think people have become a little too distracted by the platforms and the things that sort of are there to help, but they're sort of viewing them as the be all and end all. And I think they forget that, you know, whenever I'm doing presentations or stuff like that, you know, I did one a little while ago at Music Allies Connect conference, and you can find it on YouTube. But, you know, in that I was kind of saying, you know, I don't think marketing as a concept has changed in like 100 years. And I think most marketing books are kind of rewrites, really, of how to make friends and influence people. They're all updating them and shooting them through the new filter of, you know, now social media, but prior to that, it would have been websites and the internet more generally. Prior to that, possibly, you know, how to get press and attention, whatever. But the underlying mechanics of marketing, I think, have remained the same, you know. And I feel like at the moment, people are losing their way. You know, they're getting too dragged into the platforms and the minutiae, and I think they're just losing sight of what marketing really is. And like I said, when you boil it down to it, it's about emotion and connection when it's art, you know, whether it's visual art or, you know, films or music, it's the same. It's how people connect with that. So it's nurturing that. And don't get too obsessed on the, you know, does that mean you have to be on Instagram? Not really. You know, you can be, but there's a lot of other ways to do that as well. So I think it's, you know, it's getting back to basics in a strange way. Understanding this stuff and then responding accordingly.
That's powerful. Yeah. And I love this conversation, because I agree. It seems like it's easy to have sort of like shiny object syndrome and wanting to know like what's like the next hack or the next tactic. But those things change so quickly. And if you focus on the fundamentals and the principles that don't really change, then regardless of what the tactic is, like, you know, you're doing the right things. You can catch that the next wave.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always say it as kind of like, don't be ambulance chasing, by which I mean, don't be just running after whatever the latest trend is, because it's not, you know, you can do that your whole life and you won't get anywhere. You know, you have to start with a core faith and a belief in what your art is and its ability to impact people in a way that they respond. And if you start with that, then I think you've got to then look at where your audiences are to connect with them. But I don't, you know, I think too often people just assume it's like, I must build an audience on social media. And I mean, you know, it's something I've been talking about a lot of late, is just when, I mean, name any music scene of the last 50 years. Pick one. Go on.
Alternative rock.
Okay. So, I mean, if we'll reduce that to grunge.
That's pretty general.
But yeah. Let's call it grunge for now. But, you know, grunge grew out of an area, right? It was broadly grown out of Seattle. There was a lot of bands that weren't, you know, Afghan Whigs were from Cincinnati and Smashing Pumpkins was from Chicago, but Seattle was ground zero for that. You know, dubstep, ground zero was London and South London, you know, 80s hair metal, LA, you know, but everywhere started with scenes, and those scenes had a physical presence. And I think it's something that people have missed a lot lately, is like, I think we need to get back to scenes. And I think I've done a couple of workshops recently with kind of artists who've been mentored, you know, and things like that. And the interesting thing is that they, you know, there's this sort of view that they should be on social media and they've got to be working their social media game. And they're now all getting a bit worried because social media is becoming quite algorithmic, quite sort of transient. You know, it's not as simple as building a following and just posting to them. It's all gotten a bit mixed and muddy. But it's, I sort of found it was interesting because it's almost like artists assume that they're always working alone. And I think if you look back at music history, the biggest things in music didn't really happen because artists were operating alone. They happened because they recognized like minds in their physical region and came together. And that coming together creates those scenes that become a magnet for press attention and for A&R men and A&R people, you know, all that stuff. So it's kind of, it's just that, you know, I feel like we got so obsessed with big tech making things easier for us through the last 15, 20 years that now everyone's forgotten that maybe you don't need it and you can build scenes yourself. And I think that's, I really would love to see artists focusing on that more because I think there's so much power in that. And, you know, I can just, every music thing that has impacted me in my entire life, I can tell you what city it started in. You know, it wasn't some nebulous discovery on the internet. It was, they all brewed out of specific areas. And I think we could probably do with going back to that now. I think it's overdue.
So interesting. Yeah. So it sounds like what you're saying is that very rarely, if ever, like, does a artist have like a breakout success without it being a part of a movement or part of a scene? Often, you know, it's through coming together with, you know, complimentary artists and fans and this live, you know, scene that these big movements really happen.
Yeah.
It reminds me of this like wave analogy where it's almost like if you imagine like in the ocean, there's these like these waves that happen, these big waves. And, you know, if you're this little like ripple and you're trying to go against like a bigger wave, then, you know, you're not really going to be able to catch a lot of momentum. Yeah. But sometimes there are these like these bigger waves that can come along and you can swim along, you can support like, and everyone together kind of like, you know, there's this big wave that happens. And those are like these different.
It's funny you say that because that was always my analogy with marketing was like with any band, mine was the other way around. It wasn't waves coming in. It was me throwing stones out. But essentially it was like, you can throw a lot of small pebbles into a pond, right? And everyone will just land and make a mini ripple. Or you can get like a really, really big boulder and you throw that in. And it makes a massive splash. And it was sort of, my point was like, if you're doing marketing, it's like, try and think enough to line things up so that instead of just random isolated acts of marketing, you've got to sort of plan an accumulative thing going on here so that people are like, oh, okay, I've seen them here. Now I've heard them on the radio. Blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, in the old days, he says, referring to like 2012, you know, we had a monolithic culture, so it's kind of a lot easier. If you wanted to break a band, you needed press, you needed radio, you needed TV, you needed outdoor, you needed some online. And you know, if you could nail all of those, you were basically, you know, as long as the record was good, you were going to be good. You know, you'd reach those audiences. And it's this thing called the marketing rule of seven, you know, where the idea is like very few people just see or hear you and go, oh, I'm in. You know, it's a thing that they have to kind of sit there repeatedly and get exposed to it, whether it's a song or whether it's like they hear the song and think, oh, that's good. But then they're distracted because life's busy. But then if they hear it again, they'll be like, oh, there's that song again. And then if they read an interview with that band, they'll be like, oh, okay, yeah, these are the guys I was looking at, blah, blah, blah. It's that, you know. So yeah, it's a similar analogy of a sort, all involving water and all that. But yeah.
I like it. Man, you're just now we're getting like my analogy brain going. What you just shared like makes me think of like a fire pit. And it sounds like what you're saying is that rather than like scattering all these kind of unrelated pieces of content together and like these different fire pits, which may not get a whole lot of traction in and of themselves, you kind of pull them, if you stack them together in the right way.
Yeah.
And if you have like breadcrumbs that kind of lead you back to that fire.
Yeah.
Then, you know, that's a way that someone it might not light on the first try. Person is a piece of wood in this analogy, but like, you know, they might not light on the first take, but if they go to a show and there's this big fire of everyone else, it's like they leave and like they've been lit as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really it. And I think people need to think more in those terms of just, you know, something that we have this a lot with our clients where we're kind of going, you know, we've seen it in the past where people would be like, okay, what's the plan for the first single? And we're like, well, that's not the question. The question is like, where do you want to be in 3 years? And then what's the plan within that? You know, so obviously we're going to market the single, but then what? All right, and like I said, it's that thing of like, you don't just do isolated things. You're saying, right, this is going somewhere. We're building this and we're trying to elevate here. And I think people tend not to think in those terms. I think people can approach it in quite an arbitrary manner. And I think actually they need to think a bit longer term and a bit more like, what's the consequence of what I'm doing? Because I think people often just think, oh, I'll do an announcement to my followers and everyone will flock and consume in their masses. And it's like, all right, that works when you're five albums in or you're Taylor Swift, but everyone else has to do some heavy lifting and keep, you know, selling people on their new single or whatever. And so I think asking yourself all the time, you know, what am I expecting the outcome of this to be? I'm going to do this. And then what are the fans and the people I'm addressing going to do? And then what do I do to respond to that? Keep nurturing this. And, you know, to build on your analogy, Michael, you don't just light a fire. You know, you have to stack the wood the right way. And then you got to sit there fanning it a bit. You don't just flick a match in and stroll off unless you've doused it in petrol. So, you know, it takes some work to build. So it's just that, you know, you've got to understand that it does need that view of, you know, where am I going to be in weeks, months, years time, and consider it in those terms. Because I know this sounds super obvious. I'm sure people are listening going, duh, you know, but you'd be amazed. You know, I think in my experience, people really don't think in those terms. And I think with this, you need to, because if you want to be around in 3 years, you got to have a plan to be building constantly and speaking to that.
Mm. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Have you ever seen, there's like a science experiment or something. I think there's a few different folks that do like videos of this where they show the dominoes stacked up next to each other. And you might have like a little tiny domino, and then one that's like twice its size, another one that's twice its size, another one that's, and so it makes this like, this starts a little tiny domino, but then if you stack it upright, you have this giant, like human sized domino. And the experiment is that, like, you know, if you align all of those dominoes, then you push over that little tiny one. But as long as they're stacked up correctly, then that little tiny one can knock over that giant one at the end.
Yeah,
it sounds like that's what you're saying, is that, you know, rather than you setting up all these little tiny dominoes and running around frantically, like trying to push over these little dominoes, if you align those dominoes with these bigger picture ideas, then you can get some serious leverage by you know, having that stacked up together.
No, absolutely. And I think within that, it is, you know, I feel for the modern musician in the sense that most artists, like, you know, I could put $10 on the table now and say, if I went to most artists and said, you know, what would you do tomorrow if social media vanished? Let's just say everyone shuts down Instagram and TikTok and all that. And they'd all just be like, oh, I'd love that. Because then I can just go back to like doing what I actually do and what I do this for, which is to write and perform music and connect with audiences. But, you know, now I think people feel like they have to be the marketing department themselves, and they've got to come up with all these ways to be trying to connect and all this stuff. And, you know, I think a bit more planning and thought around that, to be saying, right, what am I doing? Where am I connecting? How am I doing this to bring that authenticity, I think is really key, you know, to allowing people to, you know, I think it's important for artists to be able to be themselves and find time and room for their art to grow and evolve. Because I think otherwise you spend so much time running the social media and all the other BS that kind of orbits around you, that the thing that's holding it all up, which is the music, you know, kind of falls by the wayside. So yeah, it's, you know, it requires a degree of consideration, all of this, but I don't think it needs to be, you know, overbearing or onerous. I think it's a quality, not a quantity thing. And if you want to stand out amid, you know, whatever it is, 100,000 tracks landing on DSPs every day, you've got to find ways to swim against the tide. Well, I always quite liked, there's a marketing sort of guru, this guy called Dave Trott, who I think he used to run Ogilvy in New York or something like that. You know, he held one of those kind of really high powered positions, and he writes a lot of books about sort of creativity and marketing and things like that. And I always remember him, he kind of gave this thing about, you know, sometimes it's smarter to sort of swim upstream where it's quieter, and you'll find your audience is there, or fishing upstream, you know, you catch the salmon further up rather than at the mouth when everyone's got them on the way in. And I vividly remember this being the logic we applied when we worked with Moby, and Moby had done his second album of sort of ambient music. And at the time, which was probably going back 6 or 7 years now, but there was a lot of furore around the fact that Spotify was sort of filling ambient playlists with production music and stuff that they just bought in. And it was pretty clear that they, you know, they didn't seem to have high value for that type of music. So rather than try and get Spotify's attention with that, we were looking at where else ambient music can be, you know, connecting with audiences. And at the time, it's still around, I think, but the app was called Calm, and it was a sort of wellness app, you know, with meditations and, you know, kind of guided wellness therapy, you know, audio stuff. And they, you know, I'd used it, and they had a bunch of production music on that that was all pretty bad, if I'm honest. You know, it was just sort of quite off the shelf piano tinkling, and it wasn't great at all. So we went to Calm and just said, look, we've got this record from Moby. Like, what if, you know, you were to, we gave, what if we gave it to you exclusively, you know, for like a month? What would that look like? And they bit our hands off. You know, they had, I think at the time, 55 million active users, but they put this record, like, you couldn't get away from it on the app. You know, as you open the app, it's like Moby's exclusive ambient too, you know, all this sort of thing. And they did press to all this. They did an email out to, I think they had like 50 million people on their email, you know, because they've got everyone's emails. And I mean, the level of exposure it brought was phenomenal, right? But for a kind of a release that was, you know, a difficult sell in the sense that it's not just commercial pop music. It's quite, you know, chill music that you'd fall asleep to and stuff, you know, in that sense. And I think that's what Moby created it for, was for that purpose of relaxing and everything else. But in that context of where it found that audience, it massively resonated. But I always kind of cite it as an example of, like, you know, we could have just been trying to grind away on getting Spotify and Apple Music to feature this, probably with very little success. Or you look around and go, okay, this isn't the only place to take a record like this. So let's find the other places and go there, because there's millions of people using this stuff. And so I think it, you know, it's using that nous to sort of, and it was that Dave Trott theory of, like, go where it's quieter. Don't, you know, don't fight to be heard among a whole rabble, you know. Find the other spaces to be, you know, it's easier to get attention because you're not competing with 100,000 other people. So so I always think in those terms now when we're marketing. It's sort of not where is everyone, but almost where isn't everyone? You know, it's kind of where is it easier to resonate because you're not fighting with millions of other bits of content to be heard.
Mm. That's so interesting. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And as you probably noticed by now, I'm like an analogy guy. I think all of us are. Like, it just makes it easy to understand things. But that idea of like the pool, and like everyone's fishing in the exact same pool, and if you can like go upstream and find a place that it has more space, then, you know, that's a big opportunity. Also, like shouting, like if there's a loud party and everyone's like just trying to speak up over each other, it's like, well, yeah, either you have to like get louder, and even then it's just like noisy, or like you go to somewhere that there's not a bunch of loud noises and then you can speak clearly, and it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You know, I'd say the last question, and this is, yeah, but that's potential to turn into like a rabbit hole. So we can maybe just share like we can keep it light. Although I would love to hear I'm sure you have some great perspective on this. Is just like at the time of recording this, there's such huge revolution happening with AI and technology as it represents like our capabilities as artists. And yep. There's also a lot of controversy around these tools, how they're being trained. There's fear around, you know, is this going to replace us, or what does this mean for us as artists? So I'd love to hear just your general perspective of this as like a new movement. And I know that there's been tons of like revolutions with different technology and tools, and, you know, in some ways this is very similar. I'm curious if you also think, is there something unique about this wave that, I don't know, with AGI or super intelligence, like represents a different kind of technological revolution? Curious to hear your thoughts on all of it.
I mean, I think at the moment I'm just viewing AI. Like, I feel like whenever there's a raging debate about AI going on, I just kind of want to take the word AI out and just replace it with computers, right? Because we can sort of sit here and go, computers are bad. You know, they're malware and, you know, whatever, you know, child pornography and weird stuff. You know, there's just illegal things all over and computers facilitate that. Ergo, computers are bad. You can go, okay, but computers have also made massive advances in medicine and they brought people together in ways they never could. They allow things like this to happen rather than me having to fly to the US to talk to you. You know, there's a million reasons that these things are great. And I think AI is just the same. You know, I think there's such a desire to sort of polarize everybody all of the time into extremities that, you know, the common sense gets lost in the middle. I mean, I make music myself and I've been really excited by some of the developments in AI. You know, I love the one I always cite to people is there's a synth called Synplant and they released an update that allows you to feed it a sample of anything. And it will basically replicate that, resynthesize it into a playable synth patch. But it means for people like me, if you heard this like phenomenal, you know, bass tone on a track or whatever, you know, you can just grab a snippet of that, feed it into this thing, and it will then deliver it, but fully playable. So it basically, it's like a guy's come in and taken the synth and turned all the knobs and dials to get the sound exactly that you wanted. But then from there, you can then turn them some more and go, well, I want it, you know, I don't want to exactly sound like that. I want to just to, you know, like it, but not quite like it, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And you can do all of that. So I think that's an example of where AI is great, right? It's super smart. Where I think I lose track on it is, you know, lose interest is things like Suno and Udio, where they're just like, you know, turning out whole tracks. I always liken those to like, they'd be great for, you know, when you buy like the greetings cards and you open it and it plays a song, you know, sing your happy birthday or something. I think they, you know, they could be quite funny for that. You know, if you just want to have a comedy song play to your friend, that's kind of about the level I view it on. But I think beyond that, it's kind of, it's a bit ludicrous to assume that because, you know, something can generate an AI Beatles track or whoever, you know, that we no longer need the Beatles or, you know, just insert any artist name you like in there. Because to connect with artists is so much deeper than that. You know, it's not just their music, it's their look. It's the experience of hearing them live. It, you know, it's their interviews, it's their opinions, it's all of these things.
That cultural movement that you're talking about earlier, it's that wave.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And AI can't do that. It's just never going to be able to do that, you know. So I think, it just like when synths arrived, I'm sure there were people that felt like synths didn't belong in music and they were ugly and grotesque and all this sort of stuff. And over the years, it's not replaced anything. You know, it's created a new angle for music to be explored that's delivered so much of where we are now. But it hasn't meant that there's not room for someone to stand there with a guitar and reduce someone to tears with a song of pure beauty. You know, it's all possible and all there if we want it. So, yeah, I think that I don't want to over, you know, simplify the AI argument. You know, there is a lot to resolve there. And I'm not impressed with, you know, I think the British government at the minute is kind of looking to almost, you know, overrule copyright and allow AI companies to train on the work of British artists. And that kind of thing, I just don't understand. Partly I have to say, because it feels like that's to the benefit of companies that are not British. So it strikes me as sort of odd that the British government would sell this stuff out for, you know, US companies, Chinese companies, whoever, to sort of train on their works when we don't seem to materially gain from it. So it's not even like they're going, well, it would allow British AI companies to do this so that we're doing something there. But so that sort of stuff, I think, is indefensible and pretty stupid. I think it's quite myopic and rude, to say the least, to the people that create art. But at the same time, I think this sort of, you know, I had somebody block me the other day on Blue Sky because I posted an AI-generated image of a UK actor called Brian Blessed, who's this dude with a huge beard and is best known for being in the Flash Gordon film, and he's got this big booming voice. And I got AI to sort of create him, but as like an 80s rapper. So he was there with like a Kangol hat and a big gold mic. And so someone blocked me because they just said, well, anyone posting AI-generated images is an instant block. And I'm like, wow, really? I mean, it's like, I mean, okay, man, I'm not going to fight with you about this, but it seems pretty knee-jerk and sort of, you know, I'm not an AI slop account posting crap day in, day out. You know, it was one time, and it just seems really,
often boycotted because we're using this thing called the internet, and and people don't like it. So
yeah, it's crazy. So I think generally it's, you know, it's an area that we, you know, we're right to have concerns about it, as we are any new technology and what its capabilities may be. But, you know, I think sort of like everywhere in the, you know, every corner of society at the moment seems to have been badly polarized into just like, I'm right, you're wrong. And it's all very extreme. And I don't like that. You know, I think we've got to have room for a sensible dialogue about this stuff to just, you know, approach this with some intelligence and thought and say, you know, what works for, you know, where is this good and where is it not good? I mean, AI, it looks like in health, it's making phenomenal leaps forward in things like breast cancer detection rates. You know, there's all this stuff where it is genuinely doing amazing work. So to just write it off as like, it's even and bad and wrong is like, okay, but you know, we can and should be more smart and more nuanced in our approach to this stuff. It's, we're humans. We're better than that. You know, let's see it in those terms, right?
Yeah, that's so good. I feel like you should like write a book or something. You already have. There's like some great.
It usually just gets dumped into network notes. To be honest, it's just like random thoughts of this and that. But I mean,
if you stack those dominoes together.
yeah. I mean, look. You know, with all this stuff, I just think you. You know, particularly in music at the moment, it feels like we don't make enough room for just, I guess, you know, intelligent conversation about these things. It's too polarized and too silly. And I think that's quite sad. You know, we need to try a bit harder on that.
I totally agree. I mean, I think creating space and having the ability to listen and empathize and truly try to understand, especially like opposing points of views, like often, there's truth to like both sides, but you don't get to this like emergent property from the tension, like if you're not willing to actually hear out the other side.
No.
So I couldn't agree more. And so as we approach the end of our podcast, I want to say again, thank you for taking the space to be here and share some of your, you know, experience and wisdom over the music industry over decades. And for anyone that is listening or watching this right now who's interested in connecting more or understanding better, whether they're like a music company or they're an artist, it sounds like you have kind of a holistic suite that you can use to help people. So I'm curious if you could share a little bit more about, for someone that's listening to this right now, what's the best place for them to go to learn more, connect more, and be a part of what you're building?
I mean, you know, I think if you go to our website, emoteofunknown.com, that does a pretty good job of explaining the different ways we help like artists and record labels and things like that. It sort of walks through our vision for how we help people. So I think that's a good way of understanding the kind of, I guess, how we're viewing the world and how we tend to approach things from there. And I think on a more day-to-day basis, if you go to networknotes.emoteofunknown.com, you can sign up for my newsletter that's free. And that's just sort of, you know, about once a week, I just send out really just some thoughts on, you know, all manner of topics. You know, the last one was about AI, but I've written about, you know, the need for local scenes. But I'm, you know, I'm also a big, you know, defender of the independent music space. So I'm, you know, critical of what's going on at the moment with Universal buying up so many indie companies and things like that. But so, you know, it covers a broad range of topics. But I think particularly in the last sort of 6 months, I've really tried to make it quite an optimist's newsletter as well, because I think it's a little too easy for us to lapse into like everything is bad. You know, AI is going to take all of our jobs and it's all doomed. And I choose not to sort of take that view. You know, I want to look at how we can make things better and where are the glimmers of hope, you know, and all that stuff. And they are out there. And I think it's not as bad as people often spelling it out to be. So yeah, sign up for Network Notes is probably my other thing, because I just think it's, you know, it's something that just gives food for thought as much as anything else. So yeah, but you know, we're always happy to chat to people. So if anyone's looking at what we do and getting a sense of who we work with and all those kinds of things and would like to talk more, then by all means get in touch, and you can just email like hello@motiveunknown.com, and that will come in to me and my two directors, Matt and Tom. So we're always happy to have conversations.
Awesome. I'm definitely going to go subscribe to CISO's Network Notes.
Yep. So yeah, just go to networknotes.motiveunknown.com. It's on Substack too. So if you just search Network Notes on Substack, you'll find it. But
cool.
But yeah,
and like always, for anyone that's listening to this, we'll put all the links in the show notes for easy access.
That'd be great. Thank you.
But Darren, man, great conversation. It's rare that that I get to like geek out this much on both like fundamental analogies and metaphors, which I think is really helpful to like understand. And also, I just appreciate the mindset that you approach this with in terms of like curiosity and having open conversations and trying to get to like ground truth without it being about like trying to create polarized views or extreme like fear on either side. So really enjoyed the conversation, and thank you for being on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Been great to chat. Thank you.
Hey, this is Michael, and I just wanted to say thank you for tuning into this episode of the podcast. I hope you found it really valuable, and if you want to share the word, we really appreciate you leaving a 5-star review on the podcast channel. If you want to learn more about the guest, you can check out the show notes for the links. And before you go, I wanted to remind you that I'm looking for new artists to mentor personally. Before we get started, we always offer a free 30-minute coaching call to make sure it's a good fit before you get your campaign launched. At this point, the artists that we've worked with have hit over 561.3 million streams, a number one album on iTunes, and have helped many artists grow from scratch to making a full-time income with their music online. In a few rare cases, they've even been able to generate $1 million per year with their music. That being said, we are very selective with who we work with, just based on who's the best fit and who we can best serve. And because we have a limited amount of time available for those free sessions, we do require an application process where you can submit your music and you can apply for a free coaching call with our team. So if you're interested, go ahead and click on the link in the show notes to submit an application, share one of your songs. We look forward to checking out your music, and we'll see you in the next episode.